My daddy has lots of books, and he likes to read books. And he interviews authors at KAZI. You are now going to listen to KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay.
Lisa B. Thompson's new book features three of her plays, Underground, Monroe, and The Momologues. In these plays, the Black feminist playwright and scholar thoughtfully explores themes such as the Black family, motherhood, migration, racial violence, and trauma, and its effect on Black people from the early 20th century to the present. Dr. Thompson is a professor of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of Beyond the Black Lady, Sexuality, and the New African American Middle Class. Lisa B. Thompson, welcome back to KAZI Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me. I am so excited. I was ragging everybody this morning on my morning walk, but I can't hang out. I've got to go do my interview with KAZI. You know, Hopeton Hay, right?
Well, thank you so much, because with my degree in accounting, it's always great to get praise from people out of the liberal arts background.
Right. Yes.
Let me say that I am a fan of your work. We interviewed about the Momologues, which I enjoyed immensely, saw the play. And with the publishing of your three plays, Underground, Monroe, and The Momologues, I really wanted to focus on Underground and Monroe. And I'm going to tell you that Underground and Monroe both spoke to me personally.
Wow.
Okay. Monroe, I'm from Louisiana. Stayed in Monroe. And I will tell you my experience going to a restaurant in Monroe, the racism my wife and I experienced in the 90s, going there still, how unwelcome I felt in this restaurant in Monroe in the 90s.
Wow.
So I'm from Louisiana, so I get that. And then with Underground, it brought me back to the days of protesting on campus.
Yes.
Which is, and literally, first it was a protest against the Reagan budget cuts, like 80, mm-hmm. 81, 81, yep. 82.
Absolutely.
And then it was protesting against apartheid, because that was the protest that was on my campus, Xavier University of Louisiana,
yes.
Where I went from 1978 to 82. That was the protesting that was on campus. So let's start off with Underground, which is the first play in the book. And two old friends, and I'm going to use that term loosely, brothers in the movement.
Yes.
One that came from a background of privilege, who 30 years later, still in the movement. The movement is his life. The movement is his vocation. The other one, who came from a poor background, who met Kyle, or Kay, and his name is Dixon. I got to ask you about a name like Mason Dixon. I was like, Mason Dixon. I forgot the middle name. I just kept thinking about the Mason Dixon line.
Yeah.
He came from a poor family, and he got involved with Kyle on campus. He looked up to Kyle because Kyle was leading the protest for divestiture from corporations being invested in South Africa. 30 years later, roughly, they're both around 50, late 40s. Mm-hmm. He's a successful lawyer. So he's left all that behind. Kyle pops up out of nowhere. I bet you know people like that.
Yes, we all know.
So talk about where, because it's a two person play. I enjoyed it so much. The debate about the movement, where we are today, what your obligations are, what happens when two friends get together. One has gone down one path, success, mm-hmm. upper middle class lifestyle. Left the movement behind in a manner of speaking, in terms of being an active vocal participant in the movement. And the other friend who has not left it behind, because Lisa, I have two friends who were part of the movement in the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. One built a multi-million dollar business.
Wow.
Left it behind in a manner of speaking.
Wow.
The other, when I met him in the 80s, and he was part of the movement in the late 60s, early 70s, was still in the movement, still trying to make it happen. So what was the source of this inspiration for the play Underground?
I'd say it's several things inspired this play. One of them was my experiences living through the LA uprisings in 92 and trying to find a way to process that experience of living in the city when you have the residents who are just tired of being abused, rising up. People call it the LA riots. I think there were multiple things going on at the same time. I was living there and working at the university at UCLA, and was navigating my own, a center of some of my work is, you know, the middle class, and think my own moment of class ascension at that point. I was an administrator, a low-level administrator at UCLA, before I got my PhD. And I was really struck by the way the city could shut down the Black community by closing the freeways. My partner at the time has family in South Central LA, and I lived in West LA, and trying to get ice, because they also cut the power. So getting his family ice and food and things like that. And then he was a journalist covering the riots for the LA Weekly. And he had a brother who was involved in some of the neighborhood organizations. Some people call them gangs, and how they were moving through the city. And it was interesting, you know, at parallel. It was also a weekend we were trying to move in together. So it was quite crazy. So I'm just trying to think about what it means to be where the city is locked down. Something's happening. It's coming. Kind of how we're feeling now collectively with the pandemic, that feeling of foreboding I wanted to capture. And also I did, you know, have go to school with and during this time, and our protest at UCLA as an undergraduate for the anti-apartheid protest was the largest student protest in history of California post the anti-war movement. So trying to capture that feeling and the romance of that for our generation, and then our generation now, now that we're, you know, we're not 32, 22, you know, 42, and not even right. And thinking, yes. You know, so what's come up that those folks and some of my friends that were leaders at that time, some have gone on to become successful attorneys, and some have gone on to be scholars. And interesting enough, the two men that most captured some of this for me, I went to school with, both died early. So that's an interesting thing to think about, young, you know, Black men, and how many Black men were lost from my generation, college, friends from college, was really struck me. So I didn't even realize I was thinking about Aaron and those who know me, John Caldwell, Aaron Boyer, and I was sitting in the Vortex during the rehearsal for the opening, and my college roommate, who's now my attorney, was sitting there with me, and I was sitting there, being there with her on that, in those seats, had me think, oh my God, it's John and Aaron if they had lived, because John became a lawyer, and Aaron was a goodness PhD when he died of aneurysm. So just capturing, so it's about friendship and being able to age into certain kinds of, into yourself and figuring out what that is. And then the biggest question is, what are we going to do? Is, you know, with this idea that power can cease, nothing about demand. And we saw with the uprisings, that whole urgency and the way in which things are shifting only because things are disrupted and disruptive. And I had friends for the first time from college reaching out to me to talk about political issues that they hadn't talked about before. Was we were talking about college admissions for our kids and stuff like that, right? So the Black middle class, this role in trying, we've done all the right things, and still that tension and pain. So, you know, underneath all of it, even though Mason has done well, there's still that persistent aggravation around racial disparity that is real. So I'm trying to get, so my biggest question, the debate is really, it's in my own head, right? Can this really be voted and bestseller booked away, right? I'm gonna read these books, and we're gonna vote, and then everything's gonna be fine. If the country itself is built on something that's, you know, it's unsustainable. I mean, I, you know, look, traveling around our city now, our region, Austin, and seeing all the unhoused human beings. And then I'm from California. So, you know, last time I was there, seeing that in the Bay Area brought me to tears, that it's unsustainable, the what the level of disparity.
Let me jump in here real quick, because to some degree, I think it's so important as middle-class, upwardly mobile Blacks that we don't forget those who aren't privileged and mm-hmm. upwardly mobile. To me, it's sort of like when you look at the pandemic, those of us who yes. are fortunate enough who can work from home, we got the laptops, we got the computers, yes. we can do all these other things.
Yep.
But we can't forget there are so many people who yes. don't have that. So I guess in my mind, it's sort of a questions and what Kyle, the character, is basically telling Mason, who he mentored in college, was you've made it, but you still owe, mm-hmm. in a manner of speaking. And I want you to use that prodigious intellect as an attorney to help us with the movement. Is that sort of where we're going with this?
Yeah, like, you know, you've gotten, and also that, you know, to give, you know, Mason some props. I mean, he is involved in his community, right? He works for the Boys and Girls Club. He's working with incarcerated human beings who, help, you know, teaching a class there at a college. I mean, he's doing all the things that make us feel good about ourselves in the middle class too, right? You donate, you do this, you do that. You're part of the, you know, this group. And that group that does things for the community, and that's, you know, annual scholarships for the needy. But is it really changing anything? That's the thing, I guess, is what I'm trying to suss out and work through. Because, you know, I see people on social media, which is something I enjoy. And I see folks now saying, clamoring for faculty to say, hey, why don't you guys post all your stuff online, everything you're teaching, so it's free and open to everyone, right? If school classes are gonna be online this semester, you know, give us your Zoom when your classes are up, and let the community join. And it's interesting conversation, you know. So, you know, one, it's, you know, so walking that out, that means therefore that the labor you're doing should be for you can pay by the university, but you should give it away to the people. But, you know, can you control who the people are? Is it end up being, I mean, there was a hashtag that was a while about being Black in the Ivory, and a non-Black scholar aggregated all the information and for her own data set. And so, you know, so it didn't go to the people, it went to the person that had the most ability to take advantage of that information. So so I'm saying I don't have the answers, but I'm constantly thinking about this and trying to manage it. What does it mean to yes, to be African American and look at the numbers of African Americans and Latino people and Latinx folks who are suffering because of the pandemic, because they are essential workers, or what I call, to be frank, expendable workers, right? In the minds of those who were in power, right? The Amazon, head of Amazon, or people running these food processing plants. They're not thinking about this, you know, if you're essential, pay me like I'm essential. You know, give me what I need, and they're not getting that. And I wish that everything was using. I'm a big union baby. My dad was in the union. I believe in unions. Are they perfect? No, but collective employee power is what I believe. And I was in a union in New York at my former university, and I definitely miss that collective voice and us doing things together individually. I mean, parents are now doing these pods, right, to teach their kids, because parents that have means, to be clear. Because, public schools are terrible, or I don't want my kid to have to learn online, so they're going to hire somebody that can teach their kids. And then here we are again, back to those with the most, hoarding the resources for themselves and making sure their kids come out on top. But not realizing if not everyone has a piece of the pie, then you're going to spend half of your time guarding your pie, as opposed to living your life, right? And if you're sharing the pie, means you don't have to spend all this money on ADT and bars and guns and all the other, if, you know, everybody is good, I believe, it changes the equation in terms of what things people are pushed to do. So I'm not enjoying, it's very painful for me to see.
Incredibly painful. If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Professor Dr. Lisa B. Thompson, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and we're talking about a new book, her three plays that have been published, Underground Monroe and the Momologues, excuse me. There's a great quote, because I read the book, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. In the play. And so Kyle, once again, the character that's still in the movement. He says, the truth is, talking to Mason. And this takes over one long night when he just shows up out of the blue to ask his old protege, Mason, to help him with some reparation issues. The truth is, you're the spook who sat by the door. Black folks are catching hell while a few of us enjoy fine art and Prada. 1968, 1988, 2018, Mason speaking to Kyle, saying, in essence, I'm not trying to stroll down memory lane with you. So Kyle's trying to pull Mason in, back in, saying, give us a little more support for the movement. Mason is saying, nah, matter of fact, there's a point in the play where you say, Mason says, we were just a bunch of college kids. And Kyle says, nah, we were young revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. And so I thought this is sort of the debate. I think this play written in the 1990s is so relevant to today, making that decision on what are you going to do. And I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about the Black Arts Movement, because part of it is the role of art during times when there needs to be radical change made. And what is the responsibility of the artist, the playwright?
But first, this play actually was begun. I didn't add the other element that inspired it was living in upstate New York in Albany, which is where it's set, and the snowstorms there, and how, you know, so looking at using that snow as symbolic. But it was actually, this is from the early, I guess, early 2000s that this was first written. Monroe comes in the 90s one. So,
oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. Yeah. Getting them mixed up. All right.
Yeah. So it was a completely different play when I first wrote it. I hadn't finished the whole thing, but I centered a Black woman in that piece. The woman that now is who's on the mantle at this point. But the role of the artists are, it's interesting to think about in terms of the way governments crack down on artists and intellectuals when they want to repress things. Because artists are the ones that, you know, in some ways the court jesters, right? They poke fun at things that also make us aware of the damage that's being done, of the horizon, of the joys and possibilities. The Black Arts Movement was, they say, that sister arm, artistic arm of the Black Power Movement. It was integral to getting the ideas out of those who are articulating serious goals for Black liberation, and in ways in which artists like Amiri Baraka, who actually wrote about, you know, the role of Black theater in the movement, and I love the way he thought about it as not something for the theater to be something that's in these, housed in these fancy theaters with seats and everything, but actually on the corner presenting it to the people. And I actually went to an amazing show last night. Salvage Vadenkar produced a Taji Senior's play Amendment, or The Slow Sipping of Peacock Tea. And it was a brilliant, brilliant show done at the Rogi outside. Social distance, we're all in our cars with listening to the sound. And that's the thing, is want to be innovative to deal with Black issues head on, and to invite us to dream and also to recollect. So she went backwards and forwards, right? And I was thinking about connecting people like Paul Robeson and young Black men who were slain by law enforcement. So it was really striking. So to me, that's the importance of this moment right now. We're seeing Black artists doing some amazing work, whether they're visual artists, or, which is, I'm lucky enough to have a brilliant physical, Austin-based visual artists do the cover of my book. Deborah Roberts gifted us the image for Underground Monroe, because it comes out backwards looking at on here. But this is a blown up version for presentations of the book cover. And I brought her, that she saw all the plays here in Austin and was able to think about what image would be best for the collection. So I think that visual art is very important to me as well. In all forms of Black art, both celebrating Black humanity, but also articulating some of the goals and desires for the way which we would, how we want the freedom to look. Some scholars call it the long emancipation that we're in, right? And still moving forward toward a certain kind of freedom. So the Black Arts Movement very much inspired me as a young kid, discovering those the poetry of the Black Arts Movement in junior high school and thinking, oh my God, Nikki Giovanni and other Sonia Sanchez. I was like, okay, I belong in the world and I can be a writer. I mean, so that I definitely holds a very, very important place in my heart, I would say.
So let's shift gears here. I want to get to the play of Monroe.
Yes.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 80.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Lisa B. Thompson. She is the author of three plays featured in a new book that was just published, Underground Monroe and the Momologues, three plays. And I am a fan of all three plays. I have read all three plays line by line. And with Monroe, it made me think back to, I interviewed some years ago, Caretha Mitchell, who's a professor at, I believe, Ohio State University. And she wrote a book called Living with Lynching, which I found very instructive. And then with your book, Monroe, and I did not realize the amount of lynching. I knew lynching was going on in my home state of Louisiana. I didn't realize the amount of lynching that was going on in Ouachita, Parish, which is where Monroe is. And one of the things that you write is that this play, Monroe, is dedicated to the memory of George Bolden, an illiterate Black man accused of writing a lewd note to a white woman who was lynched near Monroe, Louisiana on April 30th, 1919. So is your family from Louisiana?
Yes, sir. As I was taught to say, yes, sir. my dad's from Lake Charles and my mother is from Monroe. And they met as part of the Great Migration. They met in the Bay Area. You know, the call of the docks, you know, that I kind of allude to in Monroe, brought family members out there. So I have quite a few family members from my mom's side, the Monroe side, that moved to California, but also the Lake Charles side. My dad and my uncle both came. So it's it came out of my wondering and not really get an answer from my parents about what made, you know, you had African Americans in my Great Migration saying Detroit, Chicago, New York, DC. And my family said, oh, hell no, we're going to San Francisco.
California.
And I'm like, what? You know, and I felt like it's also was a story. It's a story that's underrepresented. Thank God for Isabel Wilkerson, who writes about Monroe actually, and worth of other sons. But before that, you know, his own idea of the Harlem Renaissance and, you know, Black, you know, Chicago and New York were people think about it, going up north. But they also went out west. And I want to talk about that experience and what people in my family felt before leaving, or I imagine them feeling, and them also what meant to be there, which is, I'm actually writing, it's part of a trilogy. Monroe is the first of a trilogy. So the second installment is called Gold, and it's set in San Francisco in 1972. And the next one after that is going to be set in the present in Texas, and it's called Flood.
So let me jump in here because I want to talk about Cherry, Clyde, and Ma Henry.
Mm.
So Cherry is the sister of a young man that's been lynched. And it's had just a devastating impact on her that has manifested itself physically in a way that she doesn't even realize. So, and Clyde was a good friend of the young man lynched in your play, Jefferson. And he's ready to go to California, to San Francisco, I believe. And he wants Cherry to come with him. But Ma Henry, Cherry's grandmother, because Cherry's being raised by her grandmother because her parents are deceased, her father was a minister, wants her to stay. And then we throw in the cousin, Viola.
Yes.
Who's coming back from Chicago. She's singing. She's working. And all the great things. And also, there's the feminism there because Cherry's repressed.
Yes.
And Viola isn't.
No, she's not.
So yeah. The discussion back and forth, the sort of the visions that Cherry has, I thought this was such a deep play on so many different levels.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for your deep reading. You're such an amazing reader. It makes me feel good to come speak to you. All my friends have been on the show. Like, yes, he's a great reader. And I do feel that with Monroe gets at some of the joys of migration and the lure of it, but also there's loss. There's nothing born of that doesn't create loss. So what does it mean for my Henry to lose the last grandchild around to the migration? And what does it mean to I think about it when we all have family funerals about the burden of my brothers who have to carry the pallbearers. And we've never talked about it, but I think about what it means to, there's a certain role, you know, that they have to play because of their gender and age. I mean, they're getting to the age now, they're going to be aging out of being the pallbearers, but what does it mean? I will never know what it's like to carry our family members to the hearse. And so it made me think about what it means. So, you know, who was it that cut people down? And someone had to cut them down, those that were lynched. And so I wanted to think, what's the impact of that? I mean, I think actually in linking it for me is to other people, like the young woman who videotaped Mr. Floyd's murder. And I didn't heard anyone talk about like her mental health. Who's sending her free therapy? I mean, what that poor child had to encounter, and you know, you're forever changed by these kinds of devastating things. So I wanted to have us think about that, and then generationally over and over again. So, yes, I that's something that's going to stay with me, and wanted to think about that. And I do remember my parents talking about lynching over family breakfast. Sunday was a big joyful day for food in the morning. So, and I remember one time it came up to, you know, so-and-so was, you know, this was happening. Our generation, we didn't, you know, ask questions, just listened and eavesdropped on our parents. You know, we're all at the same table, but we don't ask any questions and listen to what they had to say.
Lisa B. Thompson, author of the plays Underground Monroe and The Monologues, the three plays, a new book that just came out. Also the author of many other plays. Her website is lisabthompson.com. Thank you so much for being a guest on KAZR Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me. I you inspire me to write another book so I can come talk to you. I'm so smart. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this podcast edition of KAZR Book Review. Be sure to like my Facebook page entitled KAZR Book Review. And my Twitter handle is @KAZI Books. And my Instagram handle is KAZI_book_review. Have a great day.